dreams are the source of our own sanity, as well as a look into our natural insanity. The fellow I have with me here is someone who I've gone on retreats with a number of times, Tom Lane, Reverend Tom Lane, actually, who does dream work and has been for many years. And Tom, say hello and tell us about yourself.
Well, I'm grateful to be here, Paul, and I live in Greensboro, where I'm a licensed professional counselor, as well as a Presbyterian minister doing the counseling kind of ministry. I also am a founder of Journey Conferences, which is an organization to enable the ongoing dialogue between the work of Carl Jung and Christianity and other faiths.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Along with that, I do dream work retreats, and I'll also be I'm doing a gathering for just men coming up January 25th, Friday evening through Sunday at 3 p.m. on the 27th up in Stoneville, close by. A shameless plug.
Right. And actually, if you listen to this show and you're relatively local in the North Carolina area, we'll definitely... Why don't you give us your phone number now, and we'll also give it at the end, Tom.
Sure. They can find out about the Men's Dream Retreat at understandyourdream.com/events, and also could call me at 336-545-1200. The number is on the website, www.understandyourdream.com/events. I'll also be teaching a course at UNCG in the CALL program, the Community Learning Program.
Uh-huh.
And that will be on Wednesday evenings, February 13 through March 12, from 7 to 9 p.m., and they can call the UNCG CALL program to find out more about that.
Yeah, so if any of you actually know anyone in the Greensboro area who might be interested in doing dream work, I'm sure Tom gives an excellent introduction to how to do this. One of the other associations that Tom and I have is that we're both members of the local Carl Jung Booster Society, in which go and listen to lectures by various Jungian therapists on stuff. Jungianism is definitely a way of understanding, self-understanding, and a way of interpreting dreams. However, it isn't, and though it's as important as it has been, it isn't in itself the only way to know how to interpret dreams. There are many other forms of interpretation out there and approaches to dreams. And in fact, every dream interpreter is a dreamer first. And one of the things I thought would be kind of fun to do and in fact, I deliberately remembered several of my dreams from the last couple of nights because I thought it would be kind of fun to... play around with this, but before play around with this by sharing some of my dreams. By the way, folks, I didn't tell you what you're listening to. This show is called Touchstones, a Religious Experience, and I'm your host, Paul Nagy. So, if now you know where you are and who you might be listening to, Tom Lane and Paul Nagy talking about dream interpretation. Until 12 noon or thereabouts. Of course, maybe the clock is melting off the side of the table. Surrealism obviously had a great deal to deal with dreams and used dreams a great deal as a way of liberating the imagination. In fact, that was almost their carrion call, or clarion call, not carrion call, they weren't their clarion call to make things is that the imagination was autonomous. In other words, it had its own realm of understanding and meaning and being, and it and its liberation was a social liberation. So they were very pro. They became very pro socialist and communist, in the sense that strictures of class society would melt in your dreams. Let's face it, folks, you can do anything you want in your dreams, and it's okay. There are no sins in dreams. I think that's really important. In fact, when I was in seminary, professional religious, many of whom were, vowed celibate, were very concerned when they would have these, salacious dreams of making love to whomever, and they would feel guilty about them. And one dream worker, a very well-known one named Jeremy Taylor, used to say, well, folks, what you should really consider when you have dreams of having sex with someone is that is really symbolic of communing with the divine. And, of course, myself with my typical reactive So I said, every time I dream, I'm communing with the divine. Does that mean I really want to have sex? Tom, let me tell you about a dream I had two nights ago. This was the more extraordinary of the two dreams. It starts out in a typical dream in which I am having sex, so I guess I am communicating with the vine, and there's these lovely, wonderful women, none of whom, unfortunately, correspond to anybody I actually know, but we were enjoying each other's presence in a variety of interesting ways. Needless to say, I don't need to discuss exactly how. And after a while, I discovered that they're breaking into two separate groups. And the new people, all of whom are dream people that have no correspondence with real life, are going to a society, a city. And this city is the famous dream city of the world in which all the dream people live. And I had heard of this because I had read great volumes of esoteric lore. And, of course, at this point, I know that I'm dreaming. So the rest of the dream, I'm in that wonderful paradoxical state of being aware that I'm dreaming and I'm in a dream. However, I'm in a dream where I want to hang out with the people in the dream city, and we're taking a boat there. So we're on the way with the boat, and we go hang out with the people in the dream city, and they show me around. And we talk about the various levels of dreaming, and the angelic hierarchies of the dream, and it's sort of like God is like a big furnace, that sort of lights up and powers the whole city. And people live there and do quite well and so forth and so on. And there's a sort of kind of understanding that everything is divine. Everything is part of that they are this dream things, and they all, some of them, say, well, I remember when I thought I wasn't a dream, they would tell me, and they would go on and explain these various sundry things to me. And I said, well, I still wake up at times and I don't think I'm a dream, but I know I'm really a dream too. And I'd like to really hang out with you. And I said, well, you can hang out with us, but basically, you got to go back to your forgetfulness too. And forgetfulness, as I hate to tell you, in dream time is when you're awake, which I might be now. I might be awake now, and so I was thinking, and so I kind of regretted it because some of these ladies that I was flirting with, as it were dream city ladies. And they were going to hang out there, and I couldn't meet him here. And there was just there was no correspondence. The time, as it were, was in flux. They had all, been other places and done other things and, followed various climes, which I guess is a fancy poetic word for different historical epochs. So that was my first dream. And, of course, the interesting thing about it, which is kind of unusual even for me, that is that it was fully alive in its paradoxality, for as soon as the Dream City was mentioned, it was sort of like a key term which really made me aware that I was self-consciously dreaming this dream and knowing it. So, Tom, what do we do with that?
Well, first of all, let me say a few things about dreams and the nature of the dreaming process. It's interesting that Carl Jung, who said to have studied 65,000 dreams of his own and others before speaking publicly about dreams, once said, "I have no theory about dreams. I do not know how dreams arise. On the other hand, I know that if we meditate on a dream sufficiently long and thoroughly, if we take it about with us and turn it over and over, something almost always comes out of it." So when we think about what's important about a dream, Jung's view was that the most important thing about the dream is the experience of the dream itself. And we have to be aware of that as we begin to talk intellectually about the dream. The dream is really helping us try to bring together our ego, that consciousness that we ordinarily live with, and that aspect of us that we screen out of our consciousness, our unconscious. We're simply not aware of it. And to put those aspects of us in dialogue so that we can live more fully, richly, and deeply.
Right, right. And I guess, if anything, the unconscious is probably more pervasive than the conscious. We're sort of, the consciousness is like a little cork, on the top of the bathtub of our unconscious.
That's a good way to put it. The other thing that we probably should say about dreams, and it's interesting, these thoughts are not new to dream theorists at all, but Jeremy Taylor, whom you mentioned, sort of gathered these in one portable sheet, and the four, what he would think of maybe in a different order as the four most essential things to know about dreams. Would be that dreams speak a universal language and come in the service of health and wholeness.
Yeah, and that normally that's a natural symbolic language.
Yes, and that dreams speak in each vocabulary that is overdetermined. In other words, that's a technical way of saying they have multiple layers of meaning, and because they speak in this sort of language of symbol and metaphor, and because when one goes to sleep, the more rational aspect of one's brain also goes to sleep, and that lets in all the things that are more instinctual.
Yeah, and one of the ways that we could see this is as rationality in the univocal sense rather than the multivocal sense is A equals A and B equals B. However, when you're when you dream A equals the whole alphabet and B equals the whole alphabet, right? In fact, B may equal a whole different new alphabet that A doesn't represent. So, in other words, so that means that A can be A, B, C, D, E, F, and a G, and that can be confusing. And for us who think that reality is univocal, that Paul is only me, this Paul, not you out there, Paul, but the other or any other Paul, but just this Paul. You can see that'd be a little difficult.
Yeah, and that's, as you were intimating, that's why dreams are often so confusing and hard to understand, perhaps because whatever it is that is staging our dream, so to speak, is trying to communicate these multiple layers of meaning using the best available symbols. So
what else? What else did Jeremy Taylor sum up for?
Well, a few things would be that dreams don't come to tell you what you already know. That the economy of whatever it is that produces dreams in us always seeks to break new ground and invite us to new understandings and insights. In the Christian tradition, we would talk about revelatory dreams are revelatory.
Or the other one is for people who are fans of mystery stories is that everything is ultimately a mystery. Again, not the classic mystery story, which is univocal. You know, there's one murderer to the murderee, but rather, possibly that there is this fundamental strangeness or some fundamental newness or a fundamental familiarity. Sometimes familiarity is disguised as newness, particularly in dreams. Things are very paradoxical in dreams. Everything seems to be its opposite at the same time that it's itself.
Absolutely.
And what's his last point?
Well, that there's no such thing as a dream with only one meaning, as we said. And then finally, that only the dreamer can say with any certainty what meanings his or her dream may have. At least that certainty usually comes with a sense of aha or a feeling that it clicks or that it's almost like a form of recovered memory. So it's the kind of feeling one has when you are rushing somewhere and you drive out your driveway and onto the street and out to the stop sign and you make a left turn and all of a sudden you remember that you left something important on your dresser. It's that kind of there's a felt shift in the body. There's a sense that I remember that. I already knew it, but I didn't. But somehow it comes into play in a new way.
Yeah. You know, and some dreams can deal with some pretty loaded material at times. You know, stuff that we don't really want to see because, you know, for who we are. And like I remember in a situation where the dream was telling me that this guy was a spendthrift and he was irresponsible and he wanted somebody fundamentally to take care of him. He was like a little boy who wanted some parents around. And, so I said, you know, if that was my dream, I was getting that. I said, you know, I would say that would be my understanding of this thing would be that I'd be a spendthrift, you know, and I just couldn't handle the money and stuff. And of course, he immediately turned around and said, yeah. He says, that's true. He says, I can't handle money at all. He says, I've never have enough of it. And every time I get any, it all disappears. And, you know, so it was obviously something he already knew, but I didn't know it about him, but the dream elements gave me elements of it. However, as you may have noticed, Tom, because I set it up that way, we used a technique which is common in Jeremy Taylor's suggested dream work, which is when you do decide to suggest something that may be either complimentary or derogatory, depending upon the unknown other person's point of view, you always attribute it to yourself. In other words, when somebody shares a dream, like I shared a few minutes ago with Tom, I'm giving you the dream so that you can dream it along with me. Now, of course, it may not have the same strong imagery or sense of impressions, but ultimately it becomes a dream that you dream with your own dreaming faculty that, you know, may be relatively dormant or awake in our self. You know, in fact, doing dream work is a way of, you know, making acquaintance with your waking dream qualities, which are, you know, good qualities to have because there's more fun in the language when you learn how to pun and otherwise play with things within the same symbolic multivariant way that dreams do naturally. You can do a little bit in a waking time. And that makes things seem a little more fun, you know, percolating along through the day. You know, the world doesn't have to be the gray thing that we think it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it opens us, I guess if a 12th or century person were thinking about the world, they would think about the world as the material world, the spiritual world, and this in-between world, the mundo imaginalis, the imaginal world. And mm-hmm. we've kind of collapsed that in our post-rational, post-enlightenment rationalism and to yeah. just reason and the material world.
Yeah, and you know, and that's actually, now let's take a little swipe at the wonderful dream researchers that are doing current dream work. And I'm just going to be thinking about the neurophysiology of dreaming in the brain that's being done and mapped recently. And unfortunately, or fortunately, or whatever the story is, a lot of these dream workers have said in a derogatory sense that dream images are nothing but the flotsam and jetsam of the brain. And it's sort of retooling itself. You know, it's the way that we retool ourselves. If we don't dream, for instance, we don't remember things from the day before. If we want to learn stuff from the day before, there's good psychophysiological, neurological reasons that it's important to get, you know, 6 to 8 hours of sleep. And if you don't get that 6 to 8 hours of sleep, whatever you learned the day before, don't stick. Don't stick in the head. So there's, you know, so there's a lot of good things that are being learned by these people in their scientific left brain way, which is the A equals A point of view. However, what they haven't done or what they have resisted is the A equals the alphabet view of the right brain that also can give something. Because though it's true that it may be at one level just the retooling or the reprogramming of our everyday consciousness that's taking place in these dreams, but if we remember them and we pay attention to them and we cultivate this multiple things, we become more open to the limits and the creative potential. And I really have to emphasize creative here with a capital C, sort of, you know, because it may be that, you know, it may be that God's in the alphabet, you know, and in the beta alphabet, you know. You know, in other words, there's a whole variety of possibilities that may be taking place down there in this unconscious, and that if you invite it in its own way into your life, and dream interpretation and remembering dreams is a way to do this in a way that, as Jeremy Taylor is trying to assert, is relatively safe and healthy to do. It doesn't necessarily, you don't always feel safe and you don't always feel healthy or feel things, but as you become more and more comfortable with the language of symbolism, you become more open to a variety of possibilities, and also including ways of understanding yourself in a multivalent way, meaning with many values. You know, you're not just one person. You're not just one role. You're not just mommy. You're not just teacher. You're not just cook. You know, you're not just hiker. You know, you've got a whole variety of possibilities. So dream work is a really important, valid spiritual path. As valid in the spirit and as intense as any forms of meditation. In fact, I wouldn't say you should do dream work instead of meditate, but if you meditate and you do a little dream work, you would find that you would proceed probably in terms of getting to know yourself much quicker in a more holistic way if you did both to a degree, I would think.
In response to your comment about the scientists that disregard the whole right brain side of focusing on dreams and so forth, one has to ask, by what scientific method do they make that kind of assertion?
And I guess it's the assertion that if they don't get all the plugs plugged in right and all the circuits running right, the machine don't record the processes in the brain that they can look at. So, I mean, so they need to keep things, they need to keep, you know, the A column and the A column and the B column and the B column.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, they can't do their mapping.
Yes. And one must say that even people that hold that kind of tightly restrictive view toward dreams wake up in the middle of the night sometimes with the kind of experience that says, "I didn't. First of all, I didn't. I didn't create this."
Yeah, right. Yeah. Who's this? Who's doing this? Who's doing this? So to recap, I had a paradoxical dream in which I was initially just happily making love to some wonderful strange women, and then after a while we decided that we would go away, and they told me about the dream city that they were going to, and I immediately knew then that I was asleep and that I wanted to hang out of the dream city too.
Yeah.
So, Tom, if that were your dream, what would it?
Yeah. Well, this is using this form, if it were my dream, as a way of being honest and owning one's own projections onto the imagined version of the dream dream report that's shared. Because really, that's all of us who have heard Paul's dream have our own imagined version of the dream. And it's very concrete and specific.
Right, right.
It's a picture in our mind that may be very different than the picture that Paul has, as he, even one step removed from the actual experience of the dream, gives us this report.
Right, right.
So we have to find, first of all, we have to ask some questions that will help us get closer, as close as we can, with our picture of the dream to what Paul's dream report is.
So do you like to call this clarification or something?
Clarification is a good way to think about it. So we start with the beginning of the dream, and
right. Okay. One
of the things you said, Paul, was that the woman with whom you were making love was not someone from your waking life that you could recognize.
Yeah, yeah. So, which is too bad because she was real hot.
So one of the inferences I would make from that is that that is an anterior feminine aspect of the dreamer. If it were my dream, I would think of this as something, some part of my, what Jung would talked about as the anima, which was the contrasexual aspect of a male dreamer.
Right.
And use the word anima, which is Latin for soul.
So I was communing with my soul in a relatively nice way.
Uh-huh. Which is a way of saying that at some level, this may be, in my version of the dream, some kind of integration, reflecting some kind of the dream ego integrating in some way some aspect of one's soul. It's a spiritual, there's an element of a spiritual experience in this dream, and that's how it begins.
The only thing I need to say is that there was, as it were, it was not a menage a trois, it was sort of a menage a trois quattro.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
There were several other women in this dream, too. I don't know how I became so potent all of a sudden, but in the dream I was quite happy, as it were, being amongst these ladies.
Yes. And so it's a felicitous experience. It's an experience that somehow is ecstatic in my version of the dream for the dreamer, of course one wants to know how does the is this a typical kind of dream for the dreamer, or is it unusual to have more than one feminine sexual partner in the dream?
Personally, in terms of the dreams that I recall, I rarely have dreams of sexuality. I'm more likely to have a dream of, you know, walking hand in hand with Jesus than I am to have a, sorry, folks, that I am going to have a dream, you know, of, kissing somebody or kissing my lady friend. And, those are relatively uncommon. In fact, I think that was one of the reasons why I sort of remembered it. In fact, I kind of remember in terms of my, you know, paradoxical dream commentary. In other words, I'm talking to myself. I know I'm dreaming, and I'm dreaming the dream, and I'm also, you know, commenting upon dreaming the dream. I'm thinking, gee whiz, I said, this is good. I said, I haven't had a dream like this in such a long time. I like this dream. I wished I'd dream like this more often.
And there's a quality in it, being having an inner dream figures, feminine figures, that there's a quality of the dream that is archetypal, and that it's more universal, universal to the species. And however, in understanding a dream, one needs to ask, and this is where you feel free to share or not share, what was going on in your life at the time of the dream, whether anything that you can sort of make a connection to that
might have sparked this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it does, you know, come at the tail end of having, you know, had a major birthday party this over the weekend.
And yes, the 60th birthday, huh?
Yeah, right. Yeah, so, you know, it's all downhill from now on. All into, I've become the Grand Senex. That's a Jungian technical term for old, wise old man.
Yes.
Mr. Senex.
Yes.
Right. And, but the... leave, as it were, so the ladies decide, a few of the ladies, there's a man, that there's a couple of men in this dream too, but they come in, so I'm in a group, and they decide they're going back to their city,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's his dream city, whose name they mention, I just don't recall it, this is like it's Aruba, right, you know, and it's like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah. Oh, yes, I know this dream city, Aruba. Yes, I want to go there, too. Right, you know. But the whatever the name of the city was, I know it wasn't necessarily the name of it. That was it was what, you know, sparked me into saying, okay, what's happening? So
all of a sudden you became lucid at that time.
Yeah, definitely the mention of the city, and then getting into the boat and saying, well, I have to leave my – I'm leaving – a couple of women behind. Those are, you know, that I was on this whatever it was beforehand with. But I'm going with a couple of women who are, in this, who are from this dream city. And I want to go with where they're at. So we go, you know, I get on the boat and we go over to the dream city. And, you know, it's an easy passage. I don't remember much on the boat.
Yeah.
So what do you think? What do you think the city type thing is? How would you interpret that, Tom?
Well,
what kinds of clarification would you want?
Well, first of all, you mentioned the name of the city and so forth. Do you have any recollection as to whether the city wasn't a city that we would know, or is it completely ethereal?
You know, that was it. As soon as I heard the city, I had known that I had heard the city's name before, and that it was a city that only existed in dream space.
Mm-hmm.
It's a special dream city.
So yes.
This I know about. See, and this is why all of a sudden, oh, yes, I've studied that in some esoteric book of, you know, Shiite, cosmology, you know, that discusses, you know, the various dream cities in the world. You know, so I was really that was like, oh, yes, I've never been there, but I've heard about it.
Yes.
I've read it. I read about it. So, yeah, there was that. That was what was going on, you know.
So there's an amplification that Paul just did related to his own study and so forth. And
that was a commentary in the dream, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was, you know, as I said, I've got this paradoxality going on now. So I know I'm dreaming and I'm commenting on my dream.
Yes.
Multi-levels.
Yeah.
Dreaming and knowing, dreaming at the same time I'm aware that I am dreaming. Yeah. It's a interesting state. A lot of people do it. It's not that unusual.
Yeah. What a remarkable and beautiful experience. And the idea of getting in a boat to go there, what sense do you make of that?
Well, in the sense that, you know, that you're passing over water, and, you know, water represents classically, you know, in a almost, you know, archetypal sense, means the unconscious, represents an element in which we can't survive in alone, that we need a vessel to protect us from or to provide conveyance for us, so we don't get wet. You know, we want to stay dry. You know, this type of thing, we need a little A plus A energy, which might be the boat, you know, as opposed to the A equals the alphabet of the ocean. And, you know, so the boat sort of represents that. And the city represents both, you know, A plus A and A equals the alphabet simultaneously all the time. So
we're leaving a more familiar world. And in the process of that, we're leaving some behind. Something,
yeah.
I'm
leaving an aspect of my soul behind in the degree that I'm leaving a couple of women who are yeah. staying on the other side, staying on the shore, not going. They don't live yet in the city.
And any kind of spiritual journey where we, you can see it in mythology, there's always, always some kind of sacrifice that one makes of oneself in order to gain some other aspect of oneself. And so my version of the dream, there would be a recognition that a sacrifice has been made and that I am making a transition.
Yeah.
And carrying part of my soul with me that leaves me to a something that I'm very excited about.
Yeah, and one of the there's a lot of very interesting qualities to this dream city. One of the things is it's got a lot of people in it, but it's also like in some ways the people are the city. It's sort of like their bodies are not just their bodies that they walk around in, but their bodies are the buildings. And their bodies are the streets, and so they have a vocalness, so that everything is alive in the city, and it all partakes of the same livingness. So, you know, so you'd walk in, and you know, you'd sit on a chair, and the chair would be a person that you would, you know, have its own story to tell you, and could very much speak to you. In fact, you could speak to anything, and anything would speak back to you.
Yes,
it was. So there was this literal multivocality going on there.
Yeah,
you know, the windows would talk to you about what it was like to being a window, and the walls would talk to you about what it's like being the walls, and the colors on the walls would talk to you about what the colors mean, and the street stones would say what it's like to be a street stone, and the carts would say what it's like being the carts, and the clothes you're wearing would tell you what it's like being clothes on your back or on somebody else's back. And, you know, and it was all part of the same thing.
So all of a sudden, your world has become a complete conversation with the dream ego.
Yeah, but also moderated in a way, because in some ways, particularly now a man who was present at the beginning but not active, he and the women become more passive now, but the man sort of is offering some commentary, and then in my paradoxality of knowing that I'm asleep and dreaming, I'm offering commentary. You know, oh yes, I remember reading about this in this tome someplace. And by the way, fella, there is actually a tome that deals something with this stuff, though probably not in any way like this dream, which is a book by Henri Corbin, who was a famous French philosopher and of Shiite Islam, particularly the Islam of Iran, and it was called, and it's translated into English, very recondite book, not easy to read, but definitely worth reading if one likes to read recondite books about dreaming. Is called Spiritual Body, Celestial Earth.
Spiritual Body, Celestial Earth.
Yeah.
Wow.
Uh-huh. And yeah, it was a Bollinger book originally. It's still, I think it's still in print. And what he talks about is this very elaborated dream psychology that was part of the Ishmaeli thing, including this idea of the various climes, the various, that there were like directions in space that were only directions in dreams and not anywhere else. You know, you know, there's a north, south, east, west, up and down, and then there's onk and onk, and those are only aware, those directions you only see in the dream. You know?
There's a whole nother dimension of reality in the imaginal world that is not consciously yet known.
Yes. And it's definitely a fascinating book, and anybody who becomes interested in some of the more elaborated ways that one takes one's mythology, which is our collective dreams that we remember, and adds it to our personal stories, you can see how this stuff, you know, as it were, interpenetrates and cross-fertilizes each other. You know, that's, we are a ecosystem of dreaming and meaning, folk, not merely one plant.
You know, I would be absolutely astonished if I had such a dream, in part because I don't have the background to make a relation to all the specifics that you've mentioned. It's that to an extent this dream comes out of you, and because you have in your life the vocabulary, the experiential vocabulary to begin to make some of these amplifications and so forth, there's an esoteric quality to this utopian city.
Yeah, and remember, utopian means not only good place, but no place.
Yes. Yeah.
A good no place.
Yeah, and right. You have the background to make sense of this journey in a way that few of us would have, but in your sharing of your dream, we begin to be able to participate a little bit in the mystery and magic of it.
Yeah, well, that was the beauty of the dream, and actually why I wanted to share it with you. Now, the thing is there's no end to dream work in terms of what they mean. And I remember when I had that dream, I said, this is what I call a big dream. I don't have dreams like that very often, and I'm kind of glad that I was able to share it with you today, Tom.
I'm very honored.
But last night I had another dream, which is, you know, more ordinary, you know, in the sense that, you know, for most of it I wasn't necessarily aware that I was dreaming, but I kind of knew I was dreaming, and it was the classic. I'm very passive in this dream in a way, sort of like I'm with some friends who are showing me around in a new town. Okay? And we're visiting this place. It's opened up mainly because somebody died recently, and this would be probably related to the assassination in Pakistan, you know, Bhutto's. And I'm hanging out, and we're going into this house, and it's sort of like, well, I'm there, but I'm there just because these other people want to stop by and do their sort of condolences. And it's an extremely wealthy house. I mean, it is it's a palace. It is, you know, ornate, you know, gold in this, crystal chandeliers, massive staircases, beautiful rooms. And I go up to the room of one of the children, and I think it's one of the children of the person who had died, who's in this case is a man, not a woman. And
I didn't hear that last. I'm sorry.
In this case, is a man, not a woman.
I mean,
Bhutto died was a woman, but in this case, it was an old man who had died. And this is like this. And the house I'm in is a diplomatic house. It's like in D.C. So it's like part of a diplomatic mission, more than. And it's incredibly ornate. And I'm there, and I'm in one of the children's rooms. And I think it's one of the children of the man who had died, the statesman had died. But it's empty at the time. And actually the whole house is empty. Apparently none of the people who actually lived there are there at the time when people are coming, going through it and visiting. But what I noticed is that there's two pictures on the wall, or they're like mirrors. And what they do is they have like holographic images of the, eventually I'll learn. I think at the time the father and mother of the child who lives in this room. They're extremely vivid, alive, sort of like pure life things. And they're you can see that they're like living creatures looking down through like a glass, but you're actually looking in a mirror, and you're looking at a whole graphic image that repeats itself over and over again. So they have a limited range of movement, but it's a living portrait. It's very interesting. I probably have something like that in a few years, folks. Anyway, I don't know who's doing it, but I'm sure it's a very, very big possibility that a lot of our photographs in the future that will have these living, caring portraits where you actually look and care and it repeats itself on some kind of, loop of some sort. So it's not, but, you know, I was quite taken that there was these pictures, whom for a while, when I first saw them, I even thought the person was actually alive looking at me. And I thought, well, that's strange, because I thought he was the one who died, that we're doing our condolences for. Well, I do a repeat in the dream that I returned to the same area again after feeding in, and I noticed that I'm wrong, and that this time I see it. There's a young child living in the room, and that isn't his mother and father who are in the holographic images, but actually his grandmother and grandfather. And I go into the next room and I ask the kid. We talk, and I'm just trying to say, I'm doing this typical adult thing. I'm saying, what do you like about things, and what's important to you? And I'm sorry, I'm here in your house, invading your room, and he says, well, I don't live here very often. He says, and he has a British accent. I said, you don't live in your regular country either. He says, no. He says, I just live in England. So, again, it has the Bhutto theme,
Say that last again. I'm sorry.
I just live in England. I have a British accent. He has a British accent. So I said, oh, yes. I'm attending a public school there. And I said, oh, yeah, So then, when we leave, I see his father. And his father is not the grand. This is when I figured out that This is when I figure out that the grandfather was the grandfather. Before then, I thought the grandfather was the father, the image. But then I see the boy's father, who's relatively young. He's in his 30s, and I introduce myself and give my condolences. And then I'm sort of drifting along with my friends, and I notice that there's furniture for sale. Apparently all these people are running through there, so apparently somebody came in and decided that they could sell stuff. People are going to come by for condolences. They should have mementos that people can buy. Now the dream actually is one of these caravan dreams. It goes on and on and on with incredibly vivid detail, which I kind of liked. I don't remember my dreams too often, but so I'm sort of, again, being shown around, and we're walking down the street from this ornate house, and we go to Chinatown. And we go up Chinatown, we go up these very crowded old stairs that eventually become a ramp, and it's all up, 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 up. We go in there, and there's a variety of things for sale, and, there's food for sale and old clothes for sale. And I noticed I went into a bookstore, and it was empty. They had removed all the books. And the reason why is because it was winter, and apparently in winter, winter time, they didn't keep the books there because I noticed there wasn't any roof on the place. I could go on. We visited several other places like this, with this sort of strange detail. It was definitely an old city. And then I finally woke up, but that's a more ordinary dream. the thing that was most obvious to me about it was how passive I was. I really knew I didn't know where I was or where I was going, and I really needed these people to show me around because I didn't know. You know, in fact, after we had walked a ways and we got near Chinatown, this is, I don't know where I am. I don't know where, what city I'm in. I don't know where anything is. I am completely lost. I've never been here before, you know. And the people that were showing me around were people who I had known in life, and who, by the way, all of whom are now deceased, you know, so, which is interesting in itself, I guess. But I haven't actually thought what that might mean. But that's it.
What do you think now? As you
as it dawns on me what it might mean. Oh, I don't. Well, I think what it means is that these are people who, you know, who I knew very briefly, you know, in their life, and they treated me in a very sort of friendly way. And they were very nice and congenial, and of course that's what they're like in this dream, you know. And they're showing me things in a way which are much more detailed than they would have ever done in actual real life, you know. And you know, it actually kept me safe. You know, they were like, you know, safe strangers in a way, you know, as I was, you know, in some unknown place like Chicago, you know.
Yeah.
No, I think I know Chicago a little bit, but not that well.
Is that your connection with, we're asking clarification, but is that your, that the city where you connected with those people?
No, it is not in real life, no. Uh-huh. But St. Louis would have been the city, but the...
Waking life.
Yeah, in waking life, but Chicago was more like the city that I mm-hmm. was thinking of in the dream. You know, I have associations with Chicago, specifically with the surrealist movement that has been active in Chicago for the last 30 years. It's a small revival or survival of surrealism in that city. But we're actually running out of time. There's no time to interpret that dream. Not within the hour. There's never enough time for these things.
Well, sometimes it's just the beauty of living in the dream that's enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. And you know, you may never know what your dreams mean, but being able to start learning how to pay attention to them acts adds. That's what adds. Whatever those other words are, I don't know what they mean. They came out of my dream vocabulary. Adds this you know, this dimension to who you are. You know, it's a you know, and the thing is it belongs to everybody. You know, you know, it's a way of accepting yourself at all different levels and being at home with yourself.
And there's a beautiful thing about working together with dreams in this way.
Yeah.
And that is that, as I say, if it were my dream, it becomes kind of a mantra or a liturgical language by which I say there's nothing in your dream that you shared that couldn't also have been part of mine.
Exactly.
And in that sense, we begin to develop a sense of communion. We're brought to that deeper place of our humanity, common humanity that we all share.
Yeah, and as I said, you know, there is definitely a connection between dreaming and myths, and myths that we share with each other, whatever they are. Or even stories that we may take offense to say that they're myths. If the retelling of the passion of Jesus, of his various parables and stuff, which become part of our lives, some of our religious lives, the telling of the Buddha story and his quest, and even the nature of what he saw, things. There is a dream level to those things. That deserves more attention. I think specifically with the dream level thing is that we've been a little too rationalistically reductive, specifically with the way we've understood reading the Buddhist sutras or suttas from the Theravada tradition. They're dialogues of the Buddha. They're pretty didactic, which means, you know, the Buddha's always got the answer, and the disciples have always got the question. You know? And there's not a, but if you actually read those in a little more dreaming way, and also you deal specifically with those lists in a more fluid way of dreamlike things, I think it might open up a little bit more of what, particularly the later development of Buddhism in the Mahayana tradition and the Theravada and the Vajrayana, which is the tantric tradition of Buddhism. There's a deep consistency in Buddhism, but I think if we looked at that more with this natural generation of dreams, you might think, well, you know, a Christian dreamer is going to put Christian stuff on Buddhism, and a Buddhist dreamer is going to put Buddhist stuff on the story of Christ. And there's some truth to that. I mean, there's definitely evidence for that. But you know, probably the part where I would most object to Jung was his attempting to maintain what I would call the cultural solidarity of the of East is East and West is West and never the twain shall meet, which he definitely, you know, and in his day there might have still been some justification for that, but in our global society it may be that one of the ways that we truly globalize each other is by sharing our dreams.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Tom, tell people again about your dream work and how they can contact you.
They can reach me through the website at understandyourdream.com, and also the Journey Conference in October. They can learn about through the website www.journeyconferences.com. In addition,
that's in Greensboro, folks.
Yes,
where that class.
And my
is
phone
be.
Number is available on the website at understandyourdream.com/events. But it is 336-545-1200.
And you know, Tom, I suddenly realized to my chagrin that I've been talking a lot this show, and. And for that, I'm going to definitely have you back in a few months so to give you a better chance to talk.
Well, I'll be delighted to come back. But I want to say that I feel like we were just listening. We were brought into that experience that the Sufis call the Shema. There was a deeper kind of listening. And so I'm very grateful for the experience of the holy that we were sharing together in this.
Thank you, Tom. That was very gracious. Well, folks, we got to wrap it up now. You've been listening to Touchstones. This is your host, Paul Naj. And I hope that you consider that one of the great ways of religious experience is through your own dreams that you have every night. Now, I know that some of you don't think you ever remember your dreams, but if you want to remember them, they will be there. Gifts from the unconscious are gifts to ourselves. So thank you so much for being here and listening to the show. And we'll be here next week with another guest. So, thank you. So long.